This is Jim Engster. Coming today on Talk Louisiana, we'll visit with retired executive director of the Louisiana ACLU, Marjorie Essman. She'll comment on legislation permeating at the Capitol to require unanimous jury verdicts in felony trials in Louisiana. Our state's one of only two states in America that does not require a unanimous jury verdict. And former advocate columnist and NPR commentator Ed Cullen, remember him for many years on All Things Considered. Ed Cullen is here in studio to discuss the state of journalism, both locally and nationally. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar is producing, and a busy show today. Later in the hour, Ed Cullen, remarkable journalist who's lived in Baton Rouge for many years by way of Alexandria, and he was a fixture on All Things Considered for several years as well. And we'll also hear from Marjorie Essman in just a moment, who's head of the Louisiana ACLU for a decade, recently retired. And after Marjorie, it's the fabulous Emmy Sunshine, a recording sensation, a teen prodigy from Tennessee, who's performing tonight at the Red Dragon and tomorrow at the Jazz Fest. But we start with Marjorie Essman, who is defending Louisiana's, she's challenging Louisiana's longstanding rule and law that does not require a unanimous verdict. A majority verdict of 10 or more jurors can result in a felony conviction in Louisiana. So the old 12 angry men scenario of one holdout no longer works, never did in Louisiana, at least not for a long time. And now there's a move in the legislature to change this that is gaining momentum and may actually pass. The advocate has done a major series on how this law became the statute in Louisiana and why it may be outdated. Marjorie Essman, you certainly believe it's outdated. Why?
Oh, well, I could go on for a long time. First of all, I think it's important to realize the history of this. When Louisiana first became a state, we did require unanimous juries, just like every place else in the United States. And it wasn't until the Constitution of 1898 that was dropped down from unanimous to, it used to be 9 out of 12, and now it's 10 out of 12. And the reason is very clear, and there's no dispute about the fact that it was designed to perpetuate white supremacy. I mean, the record, they were unapologetic at the 1898 Constitutional Convention, which was post-Reconstruction, and they said things on the record like, you know, everything that we're doing here is to ensure the supremacy of the white race. And that is how and why our jury numbers dropped from unanimous to less than unanimous. And it was designed to ensure a steady supply of African-American men for the prison system who could then be leased out for profit. So that's the history, and there's no dispute about that. And with that history, it's pretty clear that this is something that really has no place in the 21st century. And, you know, the fact that 48 other states require unanimous verdicts indicates that Louisiana is a little out of whack. And the only other state that has a system like ours is Oregon, and they got it from us. So,
Oregon of all states.
But Oregon of all states, right. Yeah. They got it from us when somebody who was brought the Ku Klux Klan to Oregon, and with him he brought the non-unanimous jury. That's their history.
All right. 877-217-5757 or 297-5633 for Marjorie Essman, former head of the ACLU in Louisiana, based in New Orleans, and she, for 10 years, was head of the American Civil Liberties Union in Louisiana. And she, along with many others, believe it's high time for Louisiana to join 48 other states and require a unanimous jury verdict in felony trials. Why has this not been an issue before now, at least a big issue?
Well, there are a lot of reasons. It's been challenged over the decades, of course. There are a lot of defense attorneys who routinely file motions every time one of their clients is convicted in this way. But for a variety of reasons, courts have not chosen to overturn this. And, it was rewritten again into subsequent Louisiana constitutions, and so there's been a sense that, well, this has been the way it's been for a long time, so let's not change it. And I think now, in the 21st century, there's a greater awareness of, our need to get rid of the vestiges of slavery and Jim Crow. And there's just sort of a heightened recognition that this is one thing. Also, I think the understanding of the problems of mass incarceration, I mean, obviously, if it's easier to convict, you're going to end up with more convictions, many of which are wrongful. We have a very high exoneration rate in Louisiana, and the two are not unrelated. And I think there's just a larger awareness now of the fundamental flaws in our criminal justice system.
A listener asked, this is Sue downtown, asking how many people are currently in prison in Louisiana who were convicted by non-unanimous verdicts. Do you know?
But there is no way to know that because courts are not required to keep the record of jury votes. So there's no way to find out. That's one of the things that the advocate was trying to find out, and, I don't want to speak for them, but I think that they had difficulty getting that information because it's simply not available. The other thing that is not knowable is the rate at which this system leads to plea bargains. Because, a defense attorney may say, look, I could pretty well guarantee that I could convince one person, but I'm not sure I could guarantee that I could convince more than two, and so maybe you better just take a deal. So it increases the number of plea bargains, and that's also something that's unknowable.
It is. You say this has been around since 1898. It's curious that other states, southern states like Alabama and Mississippi, have done away with this, and we have not.
Well, they never had it in the first place.
They never had it.
They never had it. It was something unique to Louisiana until we exported it to Oregon. And I think that's telling, though, is that other states have not seen fit to reduce their verdict requirements to match ours. They all seem to understand that in an American system of constitutional justice, unanimity is essential. And so, we haven't seen other states running to make it easier to convict people. They seem to get it better than we have.
There are some DAs who like the system as it is.
Well, yes, because it makes their job easier. But the purpose of our system of constitutional government enshrined in the Bill of Rights is not a system that's supposed to make it easier for the government. It's supposed to make sure that the government can't convict somebody without proper due process and a fair trial. It's not the obligation of government to make the DA's job easier.
Now, there is another bill that's front page news in The Advocate today that would make it harder to determine how jurors voted in state criminal trials. It cleared the Senate yesterday. What are your thoughts about this bill perhaps going to pass the legislature?
Well, I don't know what its intention is, but it appears to be an intent to derail this movement. The problem is that defendants are entitled in this country to an open trial. Courtrooms are open. The system has to be transparent. And anything that makes it harder for the defendant to really know what happened and the public to know whether the trial was fair is a serious restriction on the rights of defendants to a fair and open trial.
I'm
very concerned about that.
You closed a recent op-ed piece by stating that a system that marginalizes many of our people and stacks the odds in favor of the government against the principle of the presumption of innocence has no place in our legal system. Marjorie concludes, it's time to ensure that all Louisiana residents get the benefit of unanimous jury verdicts. This has, as I stated, gained some momentum. Are you confident that it will pass and be signed by the governor of Louisiana?
I am very optimistic. I do want to say one thing, which is that both the Louisiana State Bar Association and the American Bar Association have come out in support of a change to unanimous juries. So Louisiana, if we don't do this, will be flying in the face of our own Bar Association and the American Bar Association, which means we're going to look really bad in front of the rest of the country. I'm very optimistic. I mean, it's sort of flown through so far. It has one more legislative hurdle, which is to pass the House of Representatives. I'm confident that the governor will sign it because he knows that this is the right thing to do. And then because it's enshrined in our Constitution, it goes to the voters. Uh-huh. And I think the challenge will be to make sure that the voters of Louisiana understand what the system is. I don't think that there's been enough awareness in the public to see that this is a problem, and that will be the next hurdle. But I think people in Louisiana understand that our system is fundamentally unfair right now, and we need to fix it.
Marjorie, lastly, Lauren in Mid-City asked about what happens if a jury votes 10 to 2 or 11 to 1 for acquittal. What happens at that point?
You can, then you have the same problem, right? I mean, then it's essentially a hung jury.
Doesn't work both ways, though.
Yes, it works both ways.
Well,
this is
you wouldn't be acquitted on an 11-to-1 vote,
no,
would you?
No, you would not. You would have a hung jury, and it would be then up to the prosecution to decide if they want to retry you. But it would also mean that they would have to, I guess, presumably, put on a better case next time, and if they can't, they can't.
But if it's 11-to-1 the other way, you're going to jail.
Now, yes, that's right. That's right. And, I had the experience of being on a jury where I was a holdout. I really just did not think that this woman, that they had shown me, to my satisfaction, that she was guilty of what she was charged with.
All right. We do have to roll. But, Marjorie, it is always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us. We'll follow this with you and be in touch. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. And we apologize for the sound issue we had with Emmy Sunshine. She was apparently not heard in some places, even though she was heard loudly and clearly in this studio. She's a fabulous young artist, and she'll be performing tonight, 8 o'clock, at the Red Dragon. And some other listeners have said that you can be acquitted on a 11-1 or 10-2 verdict in Louisiana. So the law, according to a few listeners who have contacted us, is to have 10 of 12 reach a verdict. So it works both ways, according to our erudite audience. And this bill in the legislature would change that to unanimous jury verdicts. And that's the issue that's in play, and we will follow it. Marjorie Essman, of course, is an exceptional authority on these kinds of issues. We'll be calling on her again soon. But we're joined now by Ed Cullen, the Pride of Alexandria, who for many years was a fixture on All Things Considered with his commentaries. And every Sunday I would read Attic Salt in the Advocate, and he is with us to talk about a few matters. Port Steps Baseball aired on All Things Considered in July of 2001. And after that, Ed, how many performances did you have on All Things Considered?
I think about 30 something.
30? Mm-hmm. Over 30?
Probably.
I think so. And how it's interesting how that came about.
Yeah, I mean, like so many things in my so-called career, it's just an accident. I wanted to do something for NPR. I didn't bother to read the how to go about it part on the web. I recorded something with Eric DeWeese at RKF. Sent it in, didn't specify All Things Considered or a Morning Edition. Somehow it landed on the right person's desk. They lost the recording.
Did they?
The woman who had made the recording with me in Washington left. And the unflappable DeWeese said, happens all the time. I've got a backup. And so that got on the air, and we did 30-something more.
And what was Port Steps Baseball all about?
It was about the practice, when I was a kid, of throwing a baseball against the front steps of your house, steps were usually concrete, and playing the carom as it came off the steps, and you would make up a game to go with the ball bouncing off the steps. And I was the White Sox announcer. I was the player on both teams. Yeah. And yeah.
Yeah, well, I think that's something we can all relate to of a certain vintage.
It's still there. They must have incredible amount of memory, computer memory. I think all my commentaries are at npr.org.
And it went on for a lot of years, and you at one time were on, along with Andre Kudrescu, who was teaching at LSU, and he was a regular feature on All Things Considered. We quite had quite a Baton Rouge presence.
We did, and helped me, Jack.
Jack
Hamilton was on at the same time.
He was
time.
On Marketplace, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was, we really did have a Baton Rouge presence.
Yeah, and it was... quite a collection of characters, too. And ultimately, you published a book about these commentaries, Letter in a Woodpile.
Yeah.
And it got a lot of attention. I still see copies around every now and then. And and you were known not only well here, but elsewhere.
Yeah. An editor was listening to her radio in Connecticut, I think. Excuse me. And she heard one of my commentaries, called me up at the Advocate and said, have you ever thought about doing a collection? And I said, no. But she put it together, and the book was published.
877-217-5757 is your number. 297-5633 locally for the remarkable Ed Cullen, who's still writing. I read some of his work in various publications.
Right.
And he, of course, was with The Advocate for how many years?
41.
41 years.
Yeah.
And you saw that newspaper evolve over time as the newspaper industry evolved. But I think it's fair to say that you were in the business during its heyday. We had Peter Kovacs on the other day, and he was talking about how when he was at the Picayune, they had... I think he said close to 300,000 subscribers on Sunday. Now, The Advocate is in the lead with 90,000. So, what happened to the newspaper business over time?
Well, you know, it was always amazing to even those of us on newspapers that it got out every day, that it got delivered, that it made it to people's driveways. In hurricanes, the circulation department at the paper and the marketing department won a national award after successfully delivering the paper to all our subscribers during and after a hurricane one time. But newspapers were always very expensive to produce. The Advocate was among the early papers to go computer, and as cutting edge as we were, the paper still landed in the back of a 1998 Ford Econoline van for delivery. It always depended on somebody who got up very early in the morning to deliver the paper, and I think that's part of the deal. And the rising cost of newsprint, people getting their news online, or thinking they're getting their news originating online. It's still a lot of the news we read has its origins on local newspapers and national newspapers. But as you and Peter were talking about the other morning, The big ad dollars are still in print. Everybody puts his own spin on this. I heard somebody on National Public Radio the other day saying that the money was in digital, and it's not.
No, it isn't at all.
I don't know how much The Advocate gets for a full page these days. It used to be $2,000 or $3,000 a page, depending on if it was in color or not. If it was full page,
I don't know what they're getting now. I doubt if they're getting that much now. But that's where the money is. And newspapers will go on until circulation reaches the point that so few people are getting the paper each day that advertisers won't feel that they're getting their money's worth. And I wonder when that will happen. Who knows? I was told 35 years ago by one of our production guys, get ready, print days are over, it's going to the computer. And slowly that has happened, but nowhere nearly as fast as was predicted.
And you actually have the printing press had it on location back in the day. You could hear it when it fired up, couldn't you?
Oh, you could
feel it.
You could feel the tingle in your nose and in the soles of your feet. Gutenberg, if Gutenberg walked in to the newsroom of a paper today, he wouldn't know where he was. If he had walked into the press room of the Advocate, he could have figured it out. It was still movable type. It was set on a linotype machine at the incredible rate of like 8 words a minute. If you set 8 or 10 words a minute on a linotype machine, that was blazing fast.
877-217-5757. That's the number for Ed Cullen. In our remaining time, we'll spend the rest of the hour with him. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Jim. Listen, I know I wish we could get some of C.B. Forgotson's interviews that you did with him. Some of that stuff was just wonderful. And something I didn't know until this week about how the Washington Post, when it got started, there was an attorney who was forced to defend the conspiracy people who killed, assassinated Lincoln. And that lawyer was a Union soldier. And after that trial, he went on to establish the Washington Post. He started a newspaper, and it became the Washington Post. So I thought that was a pretty bit of history that we didn't know. And as always, thank you so much, Jim.
Thank you, Phil. Newspapers, some of them have interesting origins.
They all have interesting origins. I mean, they weren't that hard to start. I think the Advocate was started by two men. One, and I think he was a professor at LSU. He dropped out pretty early, and then it went on and eventually became a Manship, a Douglas Manship senior family paper. His children ran it after him. Doug Sr. was over the television station before he came to the newspaper. I'm talking about Doug Sr. now. Mm-hmm. A wonderful man. He had the word proprietor on his door. He was, you know, that was the old word for owner. And but he was a good guy, and I had the pleasure and distinction of being thrown out of an editorial meeting one time.
Okay, we'll pick up on that. Ed Cullen thrown out of an editorial meeting. We'll talk with him some more. 877-217-5757. Back in 2 minutes. This is Jim Inkster. Thanks for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757. Ali Baltazar is producing, and Ed Cullen is our guest. Edward Joseph Ed Cullen III, born in Alexandria, Louisiana, and he spent many years at The Advocate right after college. Graduated in 1972, and he was in the trenches at the Baton Rouge newspaper, which at that time, the complex included The Advocate and the State Times. And Ed Cullen, you said as we were heading to a break, you were once thrown out of a editorial meeting. What happened?
You know, newspapers make a big deal about reporters getting thrown out of meetings. You know, we can get up our righteous indignation. Well, I spent the whole campaign for Congress when Henson Moore ran against then Congressman Rarick, after Rarick was knocked out by sports reporter
Jeff Lacaze.
Yeah. Jeff Lacaze. I mean, it was a wild and woolly race. I was with Henson one day, and one of the things we were doing that day was going before the editorial board and at the Advocate. And of course, the Advocate wanted to know his position on different things, but they were just warming up to the good stuff. They're a business, and they were just starting to talk to him about how he felt about tax rates and breaks for newspapers and all this stuff. And of course, I'd been in the meeting the whole time, and somebody looked up and saw me there and said, "Excuse me, just a minute. Do we want Ed Cullen in here?"
Yeah.
And at first, the publisher said, "Well, sure." And then I guess he got another look from somebody, and then he said, "Well, maybe not." So they asked me to leave the meeting while they talked about their newspaper business stuff.
Yeah. Well, there's always that convergence of business interests and journalistic interests. And usually in most media organizations, there's supposed to be, and often is, a wall between sales and news. But sometimes it's hard for those two sides not to intersect. What happens when that occurs?
I think if you've got good people, and I think the Advocate always had that wall. When I was at the Advocate, John George's bought the Advocate mm-hmm. about a month after I left. David Manship came to my retirement party, and he was choked up. And I thought, well, this is really really something. He's choked up at my leaving. Well, it turned out he had just signed the paper away to George's upstairs, and had come down to bid me farewell. So he wasn't choked up about my leaving.
I suspect he was.
Yeah,
but he was letting go of the family jewel.
Oh yeah, but I think George's crew has got the same integrity. I know you can't buy an ad and get a story. Though the line is getting blurred because I think sometimes they may sell packages and those ads on the front page of the newspaper at the mm-hmm. bottom of the newspaper, something you never saw.
But even the New York Times does that.
Oh,
now.
I know. I mean, it's all about making enough money to stay alive.
Well, Ed Cullen was born in August of 1946, and I bring this up because that same summer brought us the births of three U.S. presidents, Donald Trump, June of 46, George Bush, July of 46, Bill Clinton, August 19 of 46. He was born 6 days before Edward Joseph Cullen. Now, all three of those men did everything they could and were successful in staying out of harm's way during the Vietnam War.
Right.
You served with distinction.
I don't know how distinguished my service was, but I did. I did 4 years in the Navy. I made two cruises in the Gulf of Tonkin, famous for the Gulf of Tonkin incident that probably did not happen, that got us into the war in the first place. Supposed attack on the mm-hmm. on the Turner Joy, that probably didn't happen. My father was in the Navy, and I grew up wanting to be in the Navy. I wanted to go to sea. At the time, you were either in college or you were in Vietnam. If I joined the Merchant Marine, I probably would have been drafted off a Merchant Marine ship. It happened. So I joined the Navy really to go to sea. Patriotism was not really in my head. Getting killed certainly wasn't something I was willing to risk. But
you served, and these three gentlemen who have been U.S. presidents sent men and women off to fight in wars, wars that they quite possibly would have avoided if they could, since they have a record of doing this. Does that give them less credibility, and does it in any way affect the way that you look at our government? Here you are, a journalist, and you fought in the Vietnam War, and three presidents took mm-hmm. a powder.
It bothers me. It bothers the hell out of me. And the other thing that bothers me is we, the American people, are so willing to send men and women to Afghanistan and Iraq and anywhere 5 and 6 times. In Vietnam, you usually did 13 months in combat. And there were guys who went back. Most did not. Most had had mm-hmm. everything they wanted of it after 13 months. They were just happy to be alive. But to send men and women back 5 and 6 times into battle is unconscionable. I don't wish for a draft, but it will take a draft before the American people would get involved with the war. They don't think about the war. They don't think about these men and women getting killed over there or coming back maimed and what's happening to their families. That's the disgrace. I mean, we have these marches on Washington, these women's marches on Washington, Black Americans marches on Washington. Nobody's marching on Washington to end our ruinous wars, and that's very telling, I think.
And because we have a volunteer fighting force, these men and women go back and serve multiple times in combat.
They do, and that was really brought home for me. I was going through a Mickey Mouse version of air assault training at Fort Polk, and it was very Mickey Mouse. They told me right up front that I could not rappel out of a helicopter, and I pretended to be disappointed. There's no way in hell they'd have gotten me into mm-hmm. a helicopter. But the guy who was taking me through the training was this guy who was just incredibly fit. He was in his late 30s. He was an athlete. And he talked to me candidly about how long the odds are of someone making it to the age of 38, making it to retirement as a combat infantryman, which he had been most of right. his career. You get hurt. Mm-hmm. You get seriously injured. And after 8 years, you're out. You've got no pension.
Okay. A listener, Tracy, notes an interview you did for The Advocate with a very bitter Bob Edwards a few years ago. Do you recall that one?
I don't recall.
Remember when he came to LSU?
I recall interviewing him.
He was upset about his departure from NPR.
Oh, he was. And well, of course, you know. But he, you know, being a reporter, I brought it up, of course.
Of course, and he was very open about his angst.
Yeah.
And he also noted that he had a wife who was probably less than half his age at that time, Windsor Johnston, who's now on NPR as a newscaster.
Yeah.
But she was with him at the Lott Cook Center. It was quite an evening.
Yeah. I mean, he like you, is one of those interviewers who doesn't supply the answer to the question, who doesn't take 5 minutes to ask a question that you could ask in 15 seconds. I thought he was a pro. And his interview with Little Richard is a classic, because Little Richard was all over the place. And at one point, Bob Edwards said, well, and Bob Edwards, a fairly good imitation of that yodel.
Yes.
And he said to Little Richard, well, that's your trademark. And Little Richard said, that's my mark and my trade. It was a wonderful interview.
Well, Ed Cullen, we're glad you're still in the game. He writes frequently now for Country Roads and
LSU Alumni Magazine.
LSU Alumni Magazine, which is a very good publication,
it is,
by the way.
It is.
And we'll be talking again soon if everything goes according to form. The pride of Alexandria and 40 years at The Advocate and quite a career. And more than 30 commentaries on NPR. Thanks for being with us today.
All right, thank you.
Have a great weekend, and we'll be back come Monday, same time, same place. For Ali Baltazar, I'm Jim Inkster. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.